At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.
Hello, Prestige Heads. It's Derek, and I am here with another episode of the news. Danny, I believe, is no longer kneeling outside the Kremlin. He's taken his case against the Russian government to the International Court of Justice. So it's become adversarial, unfortunately, but he is still out, and I'm joined once again by returning champion Alex Jourdan. Alex is from the Quincy Institute, and well, we can get into all your stuff later on, but we should probably get into the news. I do have one thing I have to plug for the show, which is we have a new website. It's at the same link, AmericanPrestigePod.com, but it looks a lot nicer than the old one, and it should be a lot more functional. So if you have ever tried to check out the show's website and thrown up your hands, I don't blame you, but the new one should be a lot nicer. So, Alex, thanks for coming back to the show.
Of course. I'm very excited to click and scroll through your website and learn more about the world.
It's going to be an experience. It's a voyage. Drop some drugs. Not that I condone that sort of thing. And just scroll through the website and it will be a wonderful experience.
I'm imagining like a Starship Troopers-esque, like, do you want to know more?
We should have done that. Jeez, that's a misdesign flaw. Okay. We'll go back to the drawing board.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Should we get into this, Derek?
Let's do it.
All right. We'll start off with Israel-Palestine news. There's a lot this week. Most troubling is the IDF has begun its ground invasion into Gaza City. What's going on there and what's going to happen to the Palestinians in Gaza City, Derek?
Nothing good, certainly. The IDF announced overnight, Monday into Tuesday, that it was beginning its ground operation to seize Gaza City. This has been on the table for weeks now, and there's been some question as to when the Israelis would actually get going. They've been pounding northern Gaza and advancing into the outskirts of Gaza City, but as to when they were actually gonna finally start heading into the main residential areas in the downtown area, or what's left of it, I should preface that by saying this place has already been obliterated at least once over. But there were some questions as to when they were going to do that. Concerns about mobilizing reserves to join the effort. Concerns about at least appearing to allow enough time for people to evacuate before the Israelis go in. But they finally announced the beginning of that operation, as I said, overnight Monday into Tuesday. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz hopped on the social media on Tuesday to declare that Gaza is burning after a night of very heavy airstrikes, even heavier than usual. And he meant that as a brag, rather than what most normal people would take it as is a statement of abject horror. He instead was boasting, and Gaza City was indeed burning. The casualty figures that have been coming out of Gaza for the last couple of days have been very heavily tilted toward people killed and wounded in Gaza City and that general area. And I have to assume under the circumstances, if the bombardment's been as heavy as it has been, there are a lot of casualties that are probably going uncounted at this point. we're only, you know, they're only able to count the people who get to a hospital or whose bodies are brought to a hospital to be cataloged. And you can imagine people trapped under rubble. You can imagine all sorts of awful things that are taking place here.
And for context, Derek, Gaza City was one of the more populated areas in Gaza before the war, correct?
Well, right. And it still is. I mean, you know, we can talk about, this is one of the things we should talk about. The northern Gaza was emptied out to some degree early on in the genocide. The Israelis forcibly evacuated the area. But then during the ceasefire earlier this year in particular, but prior to that, really, they had opened up corridors for people to go back into northern Gaza as they were moving to obliterate central and southern Gaza. So they had allowed people to head back or to shift from the south to the north, which means that there were about a million, estimated at least a million, maybe more, probably a couple hundred thousand more people in Gaza City and northern Gaza in general when the Israelis began the first phase of this operation, the, you know, airstrikes, the, you know, sort of moving into the outskirts of the city and taking, holding those territories, bringing down high rises, which was the latest phase before the ground invasion began. It's unclear how many people evacuated. The Israeli military issued multiple evacuation orders over the last couple of weeks for people to leave. It estimated that around 350,000 Palestinians had evacuated by the time the Israelis began the ground offensive. The health ministry in Gaza has a different figure. They've estimated around 190,000 people fled, and I believe their figure was about 15,000 had come back after fleeing and realizing again that there really is no safe place for them to go in Gaza, that the areas that had been demarcated by Israeli officials as so-called safe zones had no facilities or no way to accommodate the influx of hundreds of thousands of displaced persons, re-displaced, and some of them had returned to the area. Either way, even if you go with the higher IDF figure, you've got hundreds of thousands of people still in place who are bearing the brunt of this. Thousands of them have supposedly left since Monday night, since the ground operation began. But again, there's really no way to keep track of that kind of stuff in any accurate sense under the circumstances.
And where are they go? I mean, like, where do you even go? It's like you're chased from place.
There's a lot of people who have said in interviews, as you know, reporters have gotten into Gaza City or you know, Palestinian reporters have interviewed people, have said that they're not leaving, that there's no point in leaving.
Right.
It doesn't matter where they go. They'll be killed anyway. The Israelis announced on Wednesday that they had opened up a new corridor for evacuation. But I think after... you know, this is sort of a fool me once, fool me twice kind of thing. There have been a number of times that the Israeli military said, oh, yes, we're opening up an evacuation corridor, and then it's fired on people who have gone through the corridor. So not much reason to believe that or to act on that information. The situation is you know, obviously extremely dire. They've closed off the one checkpoint that was still open into northern Gaza, Sikim, which led Oxfam and the United Nations to warn on Wednesday that, you know, once again, you're in a situation where food is running out. I'm not even sure how they would distribute it under the circumstances anyway, but still, you've got hundreds of thousands of people, you know, trying to dodge these bombs and also having nothing to eat or any sort of humanitarian support.
Nightmare. I guess this is a, you know, there was a split screen on Monday with the start of this invasion, and the UN Commission of Inquiry announcing that they found that Israel was committing a genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Could you tell us a little bit more about what the commission found and what this means, if it means
anything? Yeah, I mean, it found the Israelis guilty of violating four of the five conditions that are outlined in the 1948 Genocide Convention, any one of which could be enough for a determination that they're committing genocide. But they found them guilty of killing members of a group, causing serious bodily and mental harm, deliberately inflicting conditions calculated to destroy the group, and preventing births So four of the five standards. The Israelis, of course, claim that this is distorted and false. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said it categorically rejects the report. I hesitate to give this too much weight because there have been so many declarations from so many places of genocide, and it hasn't done anything to materially affect the situation. So this is just one more of those and more evidence that will, I'm sure, be trotted out, 10 years from now when, as the saying goes, everybody will have always been against this.
Of course.
But for right now, I don't see it making much of a difference.
Well, while we're on Israel-Palestine, we've got more nutso statements from Israeli leadership. Netanyahu said that Israel should be like Sparta.
Yes. And, I think he's hit on something here, and I'm going to explain why in a second.
Really looking for it. And then there was also Bezalel Smotrich was like, it had some comments come out.
So Smotrich is easier. He's sizing up the real estate market in Gaza, basically. Okay. And people accuse you when you bring up Bezalel Smotrich, who's only the finance minister of the Israeli government and in charge of West Bank civilian administration. But a fringe figure, obviously, in the Israeli establishment. And anytime you bring him up saying something like this, you get told that he's a friend. Nobody pays attention to this guy. He's only, one of the senior ministers in the cabinet in charge of major settlements and other aspects of the occupation. But otherwise, he's sizing up. He's talking about what a great real estate opportunity there's going to be in Gaza once all the Palestinians are gone, and really pushing, the Riviera of the Middle East plan a la Donald Trump.
Netanyahu's, so dark.
Yeah.
Let's build on top of this gravesite, mass gravesite we've created.
Right, right. I mean, that's the thing. The idea here is to wipe the slate completely clean of people, of history, of anything in Gaza, and build on top of it and just pretend that nothing ever existed there before. And to that point, they've destroyed universities, they've destroyed archaeological sites, they've destroyed churches, they've destroyed mosques, they've destroyed anything that has any cultural significance or tried to. There was a story, I think, in the Times. No, it was the AP, actually. A couple of days ago, that they reported on this group of aid workers who were informed by the IDF that they were going to blow up a warehouse containing artifacts, like archaeological, artifacts taken from Gaza, which of course is being used as a Hamas infrastructure, headquarters somehow.
Yes, those old like pots for everything. And coins are actually like bombs or something.
They're all drones or something. I don't know what it is, but and these guys had to race to like pack up as much stuff as they could and get it out of there. And a lot of stuff was destroyed during the hasty moving. A lot of stuff they had to leave behind to get to be destroyed by the IDF. And this is of a piece with, like, we're just erasing the existence of an entire people from this territory so that we can put our luxury AI cities and condos and whatever the hell else, whatever other monstrosities these people want to put in Gaza and sell it off. And that's what Smotrich is talking about.
Well, what does Netanyahu mean with the Sparta thing? Is he talking about like sexy shirtless soldiers, like 300 Netanyahu, style?
So on Monday, in really, I think his first kind of frank public comments about the fact that Israel is at least rhetorically for the moment internationally somewhat isolated. They're getting criticism from many places that they don't usually get criticism from. Even the German government of late has been like, guys, this is a little bit much.
Even Germany.
So he sort of acknowledged this and then offered that Israel should adopt the economic trappings of an autarky. And he cited Sparta, or then he cited something called Super Sparta, which I'm not sure what that is. But as a model for a city state kind of, against the world type of isolation, and that Israel needs to be able to, have a self-contained economy and to, take care of its own needs, manage its own needs. I do think he has a point here, because one of the details that people elide when they talk about Spartan individualism and rugged manliness is that the Spartans won the Peloponnesian War with a fleet that was paid for by the Persian Empire. So I think in the sense of Israel and the United States playing the role of the Persian Empire as the superpower, I think this is probably an apt comparison, but I'm sure he didn't mean it that way. Anyway, yeah, he gave this speech and sent Israeli markets like haywire. I mean, just panicked, you know, kind of selling off and you know, people freaking out about what this might mean for the Israeli economy. So then over the last couple of days, he's had to kind of walk this back a bit and say, no, I didn't mean that we're going to, you know, run into economic headwinds or anything like that. I just meant that we should be, you know, strong and independent. And it's I don't think it's working. I'm not an economist, so I can't analyze what's going on here. But my sense from what I've seen is that he's caused a bit of a jolt in the Israeli economy with this.
Interesting. Let's stay in the region here. There was this strike that Israel did in Qatar that killed or was aimed at killing Hamas negotiators. Talking with the ceasefire of the U.S. government. I think we spoke about it a bit last week, but what's the remaining fallout from this? Because it seemed like a pretty serious reaction.
Right. I mean, there's been a flurry of stuff that has accomplished very little, I think, right. Or changed very little. The Prime Minister of Qatar, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, went to Washington on Friday. He met with J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, and then had dinner with Donald Trump with the idea of, I guess, trying to maybe just to pin down what the administration story is here, because it's changed so many times about when they found out and what they knew and when they knew it. I don't think much came of that. I mean, there's been no rupture in the U.S.-Qatari relationship. And Rubio then went to Qatar earlier this week. He went on Tuesday and sort of urged the Qataris, or he said he was going there to urge the Qataris not to give up their role as mediator in the Gaza ceasefire negotiations, even though there's really nothing left to mediate at this point. And also to push what he called an enhanced defense pact between the U.S. and Qatar, which I think is interesting because the Qataris just learned that their current defense right. pact doesn't protect them from attacks by Israel.
They should have signed up for the premium defense.
Yeah, pact they didn't model. Get the yeah. like defense plus package, I guess, to protect them from Israel as well. There's been a lot of activity in the Gulf. Some things that really are would have been difficult to imagine prior to the strike, like Mohammed bin Zayed, the president of the UAE, going to Qatar and embracing the ruler of Qatar, the tarmac, Sheikh Tamim, and those two countries don't get along at all.
Sure.
So that in itself is kind of wild. There was a meeting that the Qataris hosted, an emergency meeting of the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation on Monday. They all came together to condemn the Israeli attack. But really, beyond that, there's no sense that they plan to do anything about it. It was sort of a like, okay, you can have this one, but if you do it again, we're going to be so mad with you guys. Don't test us. And, you know, then they don't really say what they're going to do. As I said, there's still a lot of questions about what the U.S. knew and when it knew what was happening. And there's been several Israeli officials who leaked to everybody's favorite court reporter, Barak Ravid, at Axios, who said that the U.S. knew, and Donald Trump personally knew, prior to the attack taking place, like not a long, like not days in advance, but far enough in advance that he could have put his foot down and mm-hmm. stopped it, or at least notified the Qataris in more timely fashion mm-hmm. than they were apparently notified. They claimed that Netanyahu called him the morning of the attack and said, "Hey, we're gonna strike this Hamas meeting in Qatar," which tears apart the whole administration story here, which is that they only found out after the U.S. military saw, kind of observed these Israeli fighters, these Israeli jets flying over the Red Sea, and said, "What are you guys doing?" And the Israelis kind of grudgingly said, "We're bombing Qatar." And that it was too late by that point. The missiles were already on the way, and they called, you know, rushed to the phone and called the Qataris, but the bombs were already falling. This version of events completely upends that.
Sure.
The response that Ravid got from the Trump administration was to call this a false accusation against the president of the United States and his administration, and a demand from an anonymous U.S. official that these Israeli people who are the Israeli officials who were leaking this to Ravid smarten up. So that's the only response to this from the U.S. But it's awkward. But I get the sense that the Qataris are just as eager as the U.S. to right. sort of let bygones be bygones here and not push too hard to find out what really happened.
I saw like last night also the administration was doing like, it was very like Brandon style cleanup story with the Wall Street Journal, where they like, there's a Wall Street Journal story that after the bombing, Trump was like, well, going around the White House being like, Netanyahu's fucking me. Like, I'm so mad.
Yeah. I mean, they've leaked a number of those where he's pissed off.
They had a hostile
phone call, and he yelled at Netanyahu, and he's been complaining. And yeah, it's the iron law of Brandonification. I think they're calling it now, which is that all presidents will eventually become Brandon.
Asymptotably approaching Brandon.
Yeah.
Oh God. All right. Well, let's we'll stick in the Middle East here. There was. Iran had like the first nuclear talks, I think, with European powers, basically since the Israel-Iran war this summer. What was
not
going
the
on?
First ones? I don't know not if they the were first, the first okay. since the Europeans triggered the snapback provision, but yeah, I mean, it was kind of an important phone meeting. They didn't meet in person, but Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister of Iran, spoke with the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and the UK. Who late last month, those three countries triggered, as I said, the snapback provision in the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which means if they don't come to some agreement with Iran on resuming nuclear inspections, on resuming talks toward a new nuclear deal, or at least agreeing to extend the current 2015 deal past when it's supposed to sunset in October, that UN sanctions and all the stuff that was in place prior to the 2015 deal, all the penalties against Iran will be put back in place as a result of this snapback. The Iranians have announced an agreement in principle with the International Atomic Energy Agency to resume inspections, although there's nothing specific yet to that. As far as resuming negotiations on another nuclear deal, that would require the Iranians and the U.S. to speak to one another, and I don't think that's happening at this point, for reasons that should be fairly self-evident. There is the possibility that they will come to some sort of agreement to just, say, take 6 months or a year and tack that on to the 2015 deal so that the snapback, you know, no longer becomes such an urgent matter for the Europeans. But apparently this phone conference that they had on Wednesday didn't make any substantive progress in any of those directions. So this is a situation to watch, because the Iranians have said that if these sanctions come back, they will take drastic action, which I assume means, you know, reconsidering their adherence to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And that would take things into a whole new stratosphere of tension if you're handicapping odds on a new conflict, a new bombing campaign, that would certainly up them quite a bit.
Right. And the snapback, that deadline is approaching.
Right. At the end of this month, they invoked it, and they invoked it late August, and there's a 30-day window before the sanctions come back. So I think September like 28th, they got about another 10 or 11 days.
Great.
Before this should come, those things should come back, barring an agreement.
All right, let's move here. There was insurgency in India. There's a group of Maoist rebels. What was going on here?
Yeah, for almost 60 years, actually, there's been a Maoist insurgency at one level or another going on in India. It's called the Naxalites. They're sometimes called Naxalites. The the rebels because of the village where the movement began. They're named after that. But yeah, 1967 to the present, this has been going on. And the Naxalites announced, or the Communist Party of India, Maoist, which is their political arm, announced on Tuesday that they are suspending their longstanding rebellion against the Indian government. This is primarily because things are not going well for the Naxalites. They, right. They've been reduced to a very low level kind of conflict with the Indian state for you know, decades now. But more to the point, in the last year or two, the Indian government has really stepped up and intensified its campaign to kind of eradicate this these insurgents. They're operating now. The Interior Ministry has said it will end the Naxalite insurgency by the end of March. And they've been killing, you know, they've been going out and security forces have been going out and targeting Naxalite cells, units, commanders. They've killed a number of senior leaders of the group, including a member, I believe, of its Politburo on Monday in one operation. So that's clearly the motivation here to suspend in suspending the uprising. There's been no comment or response, as far as I know, as yet from the Indian government, which could theoretically take the W, as the kids say, and declare that it's wrapped this up months ahead of schedule.
Right.
But then that would require negotiations of some kind with the CPI Maoist to, you know, wind things down and find something, you know, find something constructive for the now ex, I suppose, rebels to do. And it's unclear whether the Indian government is interested in that or if it just wants to end this militarily, which may be the case. We'll have to see.
Interesting. I've seen Nepal has gotten a new, an interim prime minister after this series of, I think, the Gen Z protests against corruption in the country.
Right.
And this prime minister was selected via like a broad-based Discord vote.
Discord chat. Yes.
There you go. Tell us a little more here.
So, yeah, on Friday, Ramchandra Pudel, the president of Nepal, named the former chief justice of Nepal's the Supreme Court, or its version of the Supreme Court, Sushila Karki, as its new prime minister. As you said, Karki was chosen by sort of the folks who participated in these Gen Z protests in a Discord chat. She has a reputation. She's the first woman ever to serve as Nepali prime minister. She has a reputation as an anti-corruption crusader. And the Gen Z protests, well, they began over the blocking of social media sites by the previous Nepali government. They quickly took on the character of anti-corruption protests. And anti-corruption has been a big issue for protesters in Nepal for several years now. She officially took office on Sunday. She called for calm, and security officials in the process lifted the curfew that they'd imposed in and around Kathmandu. The protests themselves were quite violent. The death toll, the last count I saw, was 72, but there were still recovering bodies from buildings that had been ransacked and burnt out. So that number may be higher at this point. I just haven't seen it. Karki promised to serve for 6 months only, and then hand power off to an elected parliament and ministers. The parliament has been dissolved. The major parties have challenged the dissolution, the legality of the dissolution, but I don't imagine that they're going to get very far with that. This is where things will be for the next 6 months. And she's going to, I mean, I would assume her main task will be trying to do something, at least something splashy about corruption before and you know, at the same time as she's sort of organizing these new elections for a more permanent government to replace hers.
All right. Well, let's stay on Gen Z related news. The U.S. and China, Xi and Trump specifically, are set to talk tomorrow in part about a framework that appears to be agreed upon on the sale of TikTok. Tell us a little bit more about this.
There's a new round of trade talks between U.S. and Chinese representatives in Madrid earlier this week. And all I've been able to determine in terms of like substantive outcomes here, I mean, they were supposed to talk, I think, about, you know, China not buying American soybeans and corn anymore, which is devastating farmers right. who voted for Donald Trump and are, you know, part of his base. I don't know that they got anywhere on that, but they did announce this framework agreement on the sale of the TikTok app. As far as I can tell, and I don't know all the technical details here, but as far as I can tell, basically the app itself would remain, like the app's algorithm and its kind of inner workings would remain more or less unchanged. The only difference is that a lot of tech bros who gave a lot of money to Donald Trump's presidential campaign will now be able to make money off of TikTok because they've come in on this sale. So, you know, good for them, I guess. There was a deadline, or actually this week, that was supposed to, passed by Congress, by which TikTok was supposed to be sold to U.S. ownership or else be discontinued in the U.S. market. That deadline has been extended several times, and I don't even know if anybody cares at this point. Certainly, it's still on online. I was just looking at Alton Brown's TikTok today, so I know it's still working. as you said, Xi and Trump are supposed to talk on Friday to kind of put a final point on this, and then I imagine they could move fairly quickly. Although quickly in these kinds of things could still be months before the deals finally, all the details are finally worked out and everybody's signed their name on the dotted line. But yes, it seems like TikTok is going to be safe, for the U.S. market. So all you kids out there, you know, don't worry. You can still, get your brain rot in, on the apps.
While we're talking about, news items that we can all breathe a deep sigh of relief about, I'm happy to be reporting that Australia has confirmed that AUKUS, as many of you might remember, one of Joe Biden's great accomplishments.
It was his greatest achievement. Nobody else could have done AUKUS. Joe Biden could have.
Yeah, as he brought up in that debate where he was like melting live on stage. Really resonated with the American people. But yeah, so AUKUS it appears to be safe. Australia is investing more into this submarine deal. What's going on here?
Yeah, they announced over the weekend that they're putting 12 billion Australian dollars, which is around 8 billion US, so hefty chunk of money, into infrastructure improvements at the Henderson Shipyard, which is the largest shipyard in Western Australia. That will turn it into what they call the maintenance hub for the AUKUS submarine fleet. That is the fleet of nuclear-powered attack submarines that the Australians are supposed to get out of AUKUS, which is, of course, Australia, the UK, and the US. That's the acronym. This deal that they hatched, it's totally not about China, so don't even say
definitely
that.
Definitely not.
But yeah, so the US will... provide the UK will build these subs with US technology, like technical assistance, and you know, Australia will be the beneficiary in that regard. But the US will get very enhanced access to Australian military bases and particularly naval bases, including the Henderson Shipyard, which will also serve as the port of call, I guess, for any US nuclear submarines that might want to take a stroll through the Pacific region.
Just a friendly stroll.
Just friendly stroll. The reason why we mention this is because the Trump administration had put AUKUS under review. Elbridge Colby at the Defense Department had been spearheading this thing. And so there was some question, although this is, you know, fairly routine. Like when Keir Starmer became Prime Minister of the UK, his government also put AUKUS under review just because it was something that was concluded by the previous government. Nevertheless, there was some, because it's Trump and the people around him, there was some uncertainty about whether this would survive. But Marco Rubio has reportedly assured the Australians that AUKUS will survive that review. And you have to assume that they would not be devoting billions of dollars toward improving the infrastructure at the shipyard if they weren't pretty sure that this was all going to survive whatever review is still going on.
I just another win in global security. Thanks.
Another win for Joe Biden. I mean, you know, he's ready for your apology, America, whenever you're ready to give it, frankly.
I apologize to Joe Biden every morning. I don't know about you guys. All right, let's move on here. There's developments in Sudan. The Rapid Support Forces, they're the RSF, appears close to taking Al-Fashir, where there's been like a long conflict over this this right. location. But what does this mean for the war in Sudan and more generally for sort of RSF prospects?
Yeah, so I mean, the RSF has been besieging Al-Fashir, which is the capital of North Darfur State. It's the last city in Darfur that's still nominally under government right. control. They've been right. besieging it for months. I hesitate to be too definitive here because there have been a number of occasions over that time where they've intensified their, you know, bombardments of the city. They've attacked the city. They've, you know, advanced on it. And you think, okay, this is it. Like, this place has been besieged for so long. It's a humanitarian disaster. It's, you know, not really, you know, the people who are defending it still, you know, resupplying them is very difficult. And so you think, this is it. Like, this, they're finally going to take it. But there was a report this week from AFP that indicated that the RSF is now setting up what a witness that they interviewed called artillery and defensive positions inside the neighboring Abu Shouk displaced persons camp, which is the largest displaced persons camp in Darfur, and has been equally targeted by the RSF for quite some time. It was previously one of two large displacement camps, and these are people who were displaced from other parts of Darfur by the RSF, which has a genocidal zeal for killing non-Arab populations in Darfur. Their roots are in the genocidal Janjaweed militia, which carried out the bulk of the Darfur genocide. But they have since taken this the other camp, the Zamzam camp, which was actually larger at one time than Abu Shouk. The RSF has since taken that camp, and now Abu Shouk seems to be falling bit by bit. And if that's the case, if the RSF is now starting to put, you know, defensive positions and artillery positions inside that camp, I think that's a pretty major development in terms of how much time Al-Fashir has left before it falls. The nightmare that's going to ensue when this finally happens, I mean, it's already a nightmare in and around that city. But when the RSF, if or when the RSF takes it, I think that's going to be a new level of horror, because these guys are not shy about massacring civilians, and there are a lot of civilians, as I said, displaced, not just the people who lived there previously, but people displaced from other parts of the region who have crowded into this city and don't really have any place to go at this point. So it's not a cheery thought.
Yeah, that's grim stuff.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. We've all done it before, turning to our barista, hairdresser, or even a random stranger for life advice. As fun as they are to talk with about everyday topics, when you're looking for help about relationships, anxiety, depression, or other clinical issues, they may not have all the right answers. Instead, get guidance from a credentialed therapist online with BetterHelp. With over 30,000 clinically trained therapists, BetterHelp has a 4.9 rating out of 1.7 million client session reviews. You can join a session at the click of a button. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Find the one with BetterHelp. Listeners get 10% off with their first month at betterhelp.com/thenation. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/thenation.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Let's move to Libya here. The internationally recognized government in Tripoli, or the UN recognized government, has cut a deal with the hostile faction that was pressing on its interests, if you will. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is potentially good news, although it's just a preliminary deal, and you know, as with any preliminary deal, it can collapse. You know, in the negotiations about what it all really means and the details. If folks have been kind of paying attention to what's going on in Libya, may recall that back in May, there was a major clash between forces, factions that are aligned with the Tripoli-based, as you said, UN-recognized government of Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah, and a group called the Special Deterrence Forces RADA, which is a militia that's nominally aligned with Dbeibah's government, but operates independently. And Dbeibah seemed to have decided, like back in May, that he was just going to take out any group in Tripoli that wasn't under his direct control. And that's what sparked this violence. There's been concern since then that the violence could restart and actually escalate into something much bigger. There are factions that are aligned to one degree or another with RADA that are based in other parts of Western Libya. And there have been reports, you know, kind of scattered reports over, you know, again, the last few months of those factions sending fighters to Tripoli and you know, potentially setting up, kind of drawing up battle lines for what could have been a major clash. But earlier this week, over the weekend, really, AFP reported that they had reached this deal. And as I say, the full details haven't been worked out, but they did come to some agreements that should reduce tensions, including an agreement to kind of jointly administer several Western Libyan airports, including the international airport that currently serves Tripoli, Mitiga, which was not Tripoli's international airport prior to the civil war, but has come to serve. It was more of a military base than anything else, but has come to serve as Tripoli's international airport since then. And RADA had been administering that facility, which is part of the reason I think that Dbeibah wanted to sort of take them out. So yeah, this is potentially a good sign. It could forestall what had been shaping up to be a potentially major battle in the city.
We'll take good news where we can give it.
I'd like to throw in a little something every once in a while.
Yeah, a little something for the fans. I noticed you neglected to thank President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton for first overthrowing the government and plunging
the
country into
civil war. I never criticized them for that in the first place. They knew what they were doing. Those guys were top of the game. Yeah.
God.
I mean, it's the Libyan people who should be thanking them, frankly. Yes, it's not,
of course,
you know, not me.
Of course, we'll send this podcast their way, see what they have to say.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move to there's like ongoing dispute and disagreement between Washington, Brussels, European governments generally over how to deal with Russia's continuing war in Ukraine and whether or not more sanctions will change Moscow's calculus in some meaningful way and how to build better quote unquote sanctions. So what's the disagreement and where's this headed?
So I don't know if you've noticed the pattern, Alex, over the past several months, but Donald Trump has a habit of threatening new sanctions on Russia because he's getting so frustrated with Vladimir Putin, who's not negotiating, and I'm really getting mad at him, and there's going to be, you know, I'm going to sanction him. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it in 2 weeks. This is all what he always says. I'm going to do it in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Then I'll know whether or not I should sanction him. And then 2 weeks come and go. And for Trump, I think 2 weeks is like, you know, it's short enough that it seems like he's actually engaged and involved in making decisions. Right. But it's long enough that he hopes that everybody will forget that he said anything about it by the time the 2 weeks elapses.
Right.
So he's repeatedly made these threats and has never pulled the trigger on any significant new sanctions. Mm-hmm. He finally, I think, hit on a formula for justifying no sanctions ever in the last week or so. And he made this clear on social media over the weekend when he announced that he will not impose any new sanctions on Europe unless the European he directed this at European NATO members,
right?
But it applies more broadly to the EU. Unless they stop buying Russian oil and tariffs on Indian and Chinese imports that mirror or even exceed, I think the ones that he wants them to do, like 100% tariffs on China, which even exceeds what the US is doing at present. And the reason I think he's probably pretty pleased with himself here is because he does have a point that the European Union has pledged its undying support to Ukraine and imposed some sanctions on the Russian economy, but it has refused to do anything that would actually like cause the European Union to give itself a haircut in any way, like not buying Russian oil.
I mean, because they use a lot of Russian oil.
They use a whole lot of Russian oil. And in fairness, even if there was a groundswell for eliminating Russian oil from the EU energy diet, there are individual member states who would probably balk at that. And the EU operates on this sort of weird consensus system, so any one member can quash the whole deal. So there are structural reasons why they may not have taken this decision, but it still speaks to, like, we're willing to help Ukraine to a point, but that's as far as we'll go.
Of course.
The Wall Street Journal also reported that he's apparently demanding that the EU seize frozen Russian banking assets that have been, you know, kind of the EU and European banks have frozen in place, that it instead take those assets and put them to use supporting Ukraine. This is another thing that the EU has refused to do because they're afraid that the other Vladimir Putins of the world will then not want to deposit their lucre in European banks, which would be bad for business. So, you know, again, kind of testing the limits of the EU's willingness to support Ukraine in that sense. They are, I think, flatly refusing to impose tariffs on India and China because that would be economic death for the EU and would leave them wholly dependent on a United States that is not dependable anymore and is not really under Trump, at least, doesn't seem to be very friendly toward Europe in general. So, you know, they're in the process of trying to diversify their economic outlook past the U.S. And here's Trump saying, no, you have to, you know, put tariffs on everybody else's goods. And by the way, I mean, you know, this demand that they stop buying Russian oil and probably natural gas, too, is transparently an attempt to get them to buy U.S. energy products instead. I mean, that's Trump's motivation. It's not out of some high-minded, you know, it's only fair if you guys take this debt. He wants to sell them U.S. energy products. There was this outrageous $750 billion demand in the U.S.-EU trade deal that the EU buy that much U.S. energy over the rest of Trump's presidency, which is just an absurd amount of money that they're never going to reach. But that's where he's coming from. And so, you know, I think at this point we're just sort of at an impasse. The EU was supposed to take up the issue of another tranche of sanctions against Russia this week and decided to postpone because they don't think the U.S. is going to do anything at this point. And there's some grumbling that Trump has made all these demands knowing that the EU would say no, and that he could then turn around and say, okay, well, this is why I'm not I'm not sanctioning Russia.
Right.
But, you know, who knows? It's all part of the wonderful North Atlantic milieu, I guess, here. So
it's incredible the extent to which, like, you know, Europe consciously vassalized itself to, like, U.S. interests, and then turning around, and they don't have any option in under an administration right. that is less friendly to them than to just like throw up their hands.
Exactly.
Good exactly. strategic thinking, guys.
Yeah. Way to go.
Way to go.
They went through it. They went through Trump won, and then right. Brandon got elected, and it was like, oh, everything's back, to normal, and that'll never happen again. Well, sorry, well. Guys. Yeah, little strategic mistake there.
Yeah, that is a great point, because that was the whole like hair on fire of the first Trump administration is, what do we do now that the U.S. is not a reliable partner? And then it's like, right. oh, never mind. And,
okay, we can go back to normal. Fine. Great.
Speaking of which, this is like, I feel like we had the president and vice president say something that we said basically as a joke last week on the show. They said it outright. After the U.S. blew up at least one more boat, it seems like two more boats in off Maybe. The shores of the Caribbean, a part of this war against narco-terrorism, as they've dubbed it. And Derek, you and I were joking, like, I wouldn't go fishing, I guess, if you're in the Caribbean, because that's yeah. a terrifying prospect.
And funny then literally
that is what the president and vice president said, is that Monroe Doctrine says that if you are fishing in Latin America, you are a legitimate target.
You are a military execution. Target. Yeah. A legitimate target to be liquidated by a U.S. drone.
What is the possible rationale, and how are they selling this?
So, I mean, it's I think indicative of the hypercharged media cycle that we go through anymore, that Trump announced on Monday that the U.S. military had blown up another boat in the Caribbean and killed three people. Mm-hmm. And, where the first bombing that killed 11 people in that initial attack was just straight up murder, that got like a week's worth of coverage and kind of hand wringing about, is this legal, what are we doing, can you just up and blow up a boat for because you feel like it, don't you need some due process here, couldn't we have interdicted? And it's all this discussion. He announced on Monday that they'd blown up another boat, and it was sort of like they got 5 seconds in the C block of the news, and that was it. And then on Tuesday, he was talking to reporters at the White House and said, we've blown up three boats. And I don't know if he meant that, or if it was just like his dying brain screaming for help, or what, or if that's actually true. But there's no information on this third boat, and he sort of coyly said, you don't know about the third one. And that's like, that didn't get any, that hardly got any mention at all. So we're at the point now where they could just start picking off speedboats, I think, anywhere in the Caribbean, and getting very little attention for it, which is a dire thing to consider. But that I think is the concern, that they've already managed to normalize. Just we saw a speedboat on a satellite and decided that there were drugs in it and blew it up. And as you say, now we've got even the president and the vice president making jokes. And I've been told over the last day or so that if you make jokes, you can get sanctioned by the FCC and taken off the air. But they're making jokes about killing people fishing, like, and you shouldn't go fishing. Don't go fishing because we might blow you up. And that's the mindset here of these people. And yeah, as you said, we sort of morbidly commented on this last week, but they're like, back slapping each other over this
right.
Idea that we could just kill a fisherman. Why not? Who cares? We decide that this person, again, as I said last week, it's the end result of the war on terror. We mm-hmm. point at somebody and say terrorist. Their life is forfeit, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
Good job, Washington. Good yeah, job giving the president around, really. This power.
Banner stuff.
And like you said, there's just like seemingly no attention to this stuff whatsoever. It's just it's like that's the the global war on terror model, is the media cares like the first exceptional time,
right.
Like when
and then Obama they care a little bit less the second American, time. By the time you get to number three, number four, okay.
This is just how
what we do. We just blow up boats.
Well, and asking questions about it is really questioning our national security officials and their expertise.
Yeah, so in a time of war like this.
Yes, a time of great. I don't understand. Trump was once a friend of the beautiful boaters, and now now this.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the beautiful boaters should consider what they've done here, or, you know, maybe just not take their boats out for a while and head to Mar-a-Lago and hit the buffet.
While we're on the drug war beat, let's go to Colombia. Once a major recipient of U.S. aid and partnership in the war on drugs, through Plan Colombia, we are now, Trump announced, I guess this last week, that he is decertifying Colombia, like basically saying, we don't like you anymore. Like, what is this?
I mean, the U.S. certifies countries as war on drugs partners or not, or decertifies them. And he decertified on Monday five countries that were previously considered partners. Afghanistan, Bolivia, Myanmar, and Venezuela were the other ones. Colombia was the big one. Colombia is now decertified for the first time in 30 years. They're no longer a partner in the war on drugs. It doesn't, to my knowledge, this hasn't affected U.S. aid or support, because the administration issued a waiver on national security grounds to maintain that support. But it does pull the rug somewhat. And it's I think, intended as a threat to the Colombian government that, all it would take is another kind of snap of the fingers and you guys will be high and dry.
How did the government respond?
Right. Well, I mean, whether or not this has anything to actually to do with counter-narcotics, it is the case that coca and cocaine production in Colombia is up, in the last couple of years. But whether that had anything to do with it or not, I don't know. Donald Trump and Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, don't get along. They don't like each other. They've clashed over migration, over deportation. They've clashed over, a number of other things. And so this may have just been a personal beef, between Trump and Petro. Petro certainly didn't take it in the spirit of constructive criticism. He accused Trump of trying to affect next year's Colombian presidential election in order to put a puppet president in place in Bogota. And ironically, this may actually affect the election, because it will allow Petro, who can't run for re-election but can certainly throw his support behind another left-wing candidate, may allow him to play on anti-American sentiment. And Petro's not terribly popular at this point himself, but he may be able to boost that to some degree and help out whoever's running to be his successor next year. Because of this decision, he can talk to Lula in Brazil about this, because Lula has seen his popularity increase over his feud with Trump. But leaving that aside, he accused Trump of trying to put a puppet president in place. He suspended Colombian arms purchases from the U.S. Things have been left on a fairly tense note, though. As I say, materially, the arms purchase that's fairly significant, but in terms of the U.S. aid that is currently going to Colombia, as far as I know, that hasn't been affected yet. It's now in a position where it's just basically up to Trump whether he wants to cut it or not.
Oh man! All right, keep our eyes out on this. Well, let's end while we're in the Western Hemisphere and our glorious, good old U.S. of A. Trump has dispatched the National Guard to Memphis. What?
Yeah, we're going into Memphis. We're taking them out. We're taking out Memphis. he announced on Monday that he signed an order to mobilize the National Guard to go into Memphis and do for Memphis what the National Guard has done for Washington, D.C., basically stand great on the things street with big guns and frighten everybody. This will be the second city that Trump has put under military occupation, and it is, I think, an important milestone. And I mean, you can say, you can argue that he did this in Los Angeles first, but I think that was different. That was an order to protect federal institutions, and technically, at least. And he does have the legal latitude to do that. So I don't think legally it was the same degree of severity here. Also, likewise, in D.C., it is within the purview of the government to federalize D.C. and send in federal law enforcement, put National Guard on the streets, et cetera. Legally, that's probably safe ground for him. But this is different. This is militarily occupying a city that's under its own governance in its own state. Really not a step that the U.S. government should be able to take legally. But he's going to try it. The reason that he's picking Memphis, and he had talked about doing this in Chicago next. The reason he's picking Memphis is because the precedent, I think, will be easier to set here. Tennessee is under a Republican governor. Illinois is under a Democratic governor. Right. The Democratic governor of Illinois was not going to cooperate with federalizing that state's National Guard forces. Right. And so there was talk of like sending the Texas National Guard to Chicago, which really would be like akin to a full-on invasion, right, to be clear. In this case, Trump should have no trouble getting the Tennessee National Guard federalized and sent into Memphis, which is, again, kind of you're taking baby steps toward what he really wants to do, which is to put, armed U.S. soldiers on the streets of U.S. cities. He's kind of rocking the vending machine to tip it over. So I think that explains why Memphis is coming next. But he will certainly take this show to places like Chicago, New York, if he's not stopped. And I don't know what mechanism you would use to stop him at this point. It's not clear that even the Supreme Court ruling that he has to stop would actually get him to do that. So I don't know what the mechanism is here, but I think he's trying to take this in kind of manageable bites before he gets to the place that he's really going.
Well, while we're on the topic of Trump pushing the bounds of law, domestic and international, next week is the UN General Assembly in New York, and there's some expectation that the Trump administration is hoping to change, or they've organized an event where they're going to be discussing changing the rules that govern people fleeing conflict in other places and claiming asylum. What's going on here, and what does that mean?
Yes, and we're finally taking down the great evildoers of our time, asylum seekers,
the refugees.
Yeah, refugees. Basically, what Trump wants to do is to apply the pseudo rules that he's kind of arbitrarily put in place about asylum seeking in the United States, apply them globally. And as you said, he's organizing, the administration's organizing a General Assembly an event on the sidelines of the General Assembly, where they're going to propose a framework. Reuters reported on the what the framework looks like, earlier this week. It's going to, include a requirement that asylum seekers claim protection in the first country they enter, rather than choosing a destination and going to that country and claiming asylum, that they're required to claim asylum as soon as they leave their own country, which would prevent many of the asylum seekers who come to the United States or attempt to come to the United States through the southern border, would prevent those folks from legally being allowed to claim asylum in the United States. They would have to claim asylum in one of the countries that they crossed, Mexico at least, if not prior to that. It would also change the rules around when you can send asylum seekers back if they are actually given asylum. It would invest the host country with the right to determine whether conditions are okay in the asylum seekers' home countries for them to be sent back, which upends the principle of what's known as refoulement, which says that you cannot return somebody to a war zone or to a place where they could realistically expect to be in danger if you sent them back. That's supposed to be determined by a somewhat, let's say, more objective authority than the host country, which will have every incentive to just send people back and at the earliest possible moment.
Well, it strikes me like what if you're fleeing a war or conflict that's sponsored by the neighboring country and that's the only place you can get to?
You have to rely on the good graces of your neighbors, I guess. it completely guts the current asylum system.
Jesus.
In favor of something where people would just, not be able to seek asylum, basically, unless you are a white South African who,
of course,
pretends that your land is being taken away or something.
Of course. And then you the only real refugees.
The only refugees in the world, the only true refugees in the world.
Lord. Well, I've got nothing happy to say at the end of that.
Yeah, neither do I.
Shitty compilation of news. Great compilation of news. Shitty bad news.
Again, to reiterate to folks, check out the new website.
Yes.
I'm told that the whole archive is now categorized and searchable for the show. All of our series are up there, collected together. There will be more series coming out in the future that will be added to that. You can listen directly on the site if you want to, although, you know, certainly all your podcast apps should still work. So check that out, AmericanPrestigePod.com. And Alex, where can people find your stuff?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Derek. And thanks again for giving me the chance to fill in for Danny here. I hope his international tribunal turns out with positive results. You guys can
Alan Dershowitz. He hired Alan Dershowitz as his lawyer. So, I mean, I'm optimistic.
Yeah. Match made in heaven. Just don't argue with him about, you know, pierogies or
whatever. There's some things you don't want to talk about, but
yeah, he's got a few topics off limits. If you're looking for, I just would encourage folks to listen to Always at War, this podcast I'm doing at the Quincy Institute with Courtney Rawlings. You can find it on YouTube or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter at Alex Jordan, ATL, Jordan spelled like Michael Jordan. I think that's pretty much it for me.
All right. I guess that's it. Check out the website. And thanks, as always, for listening, guys. And keep on rocking, et cetera, et cetera. Take it easy.
Peace.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.